The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a short story by F. Scott Fitzgerald, published for the first time in the July issue of the New Yorker magazine. It was filed in the Fitzgerald Papers at Princeton University for many decades with no title. It was identified by Anne Margaret Daniel as a complete Pat Hobby story, written in the summer of 1940, and appears in the New Yorker here on July 17th for the first time. It is published with the authorization of the trustees of the estate of F. Scott Fitzgerald. And now, Double Time for Pat Hobby, by F. Scott Fitzgerald. If Mr. DeTink continued to collapse, everything would be all right. When he ordered the prop department to mount an anti-aircraft gun on his bungalow, it looked as though the time had come, but the matter was hushed up, and Mr. DeTink struggled onward through the labyrinth of production. Sometimes, Pat Hobby dreamed of sneaking in, seizing the Benzedrine pills on Mr. DeTink's desk, and cramming them down his throat all at once. He visualized the producer stuffed with Benzedrine racing madly around and around his office, producing and producing until he collapsed. Then a long rest for Mr. DeTink, utter forgetfulness, a slow step-by-step recovery with frequent daily relapses, slipbacks, convulsions, and comas. And Pat still on the payroll of a picture that had been abandoned a month ago. "What are you writing on?" Pat was asked in the studio commissary, or "What producer are you working for?" He had two cautious answers. Either he was just starting work and didn't know it yet, or else he had just finished a job. Meanwhile, he lay low. Three times a week, he appeared in DeTink's outer office, showed himself to the secretaries, sat down for a minute, more often than not next to DeTink's doctor, who waited, bag on knee. When the doctor was admitted to the presence, Pat took advantage of the slight commotion to disappear. Then a half pint of gin from the drugstore across the street and Santa Anita for the day. But the jockeys were terribly corrupt that summer, and the $2.50 a week he received for lying low flowed swiftly into the pocket of Louis, the studio bookie. On the day that Pat met Jim Dasterson in the barrier, he had less than a dollar in one pocket and an ounce of gin in the other. Bleak and crimson-eyed, he stood under the revealing California sky, looking every year of his 49. "You look like hell," Dasterson said sympathetically. "Got a job?" Offended, Pat started to say that he was employed, but thought better of it. Dasterson, a fellow writer from better days, was a producer now. "You ought to get a new hat," Dasterson said. He was not a kindly man, but he spoke in the glow of a brilliant three-horse parlay. "Well, I'll give you a job on a picture," he said. "Did you ever work in Poland, or a law office, or a shipyard?" "Well, I worked in a shipyard," Pat said. "In Newport News during the war." "Okay, you're the technical expert on shipyards. 2 weeks at 75, Pat. How's that?" Pat pretended to hesitate. "I can ask my agent." "Well, there he is," Dasterson said, pointing suddenly. As Pat turned to look, Dasterson raised his knee abruptly into Pat's rump. "Your agent," he said contemptuously. "Don't pull that stuff on me. No agent would handle you. Come around to the lot tomorrow." Pat was not proud. He could take it. He could take everything. He had never had two jobs at once before, but what could you do with the jockeys selling out and pulling their horses? The next day he reported to Dasterson's studio and was referred to the writer on the picture. Pat had indeed worked in a shipyard once, but he was handicapped by his impression that sabotage had to do with neglect of the Sabbath day. Oh, the welders always went to church, he declared, except that on most Sundays they went to Sloppy Sam's or Bad Annie's. I'll tell you what, Mr. Dasterson's writer said hastily. I don't need that dope yet. I'm working out the love story. Please leave me your phone number and I'll get in touch with you later. Long, sunny afternoons at Santa Anita. Fat, half pints sagging comfortably in his back pocket. Did he have a job? Well, let them ask now, and he could afford to shake his head and smile, for he had two. After years of neglect, an Indian summer of prosperity had come at last. On alternate mornings, he visited the two studios, reporting one day to Mr. DeTink's office and the next to Mr. Dasterson's. He knew that, so long as he kept calling, he would always find the two men busy. In fact, the more he called, the less likely he would be to see them. And this would have been fine if he had not called on Mr. Dasterson the day the wall of his office was being repaired. A face kept regarding Pat through the broken plaster between the anteroom and the inner sanctum. It was a face he had seen before, yet could not place. The face passed and repassed the chink in the wall, and each time looked curiously out at Pat. There was something a little uncanny about it, and he was about to withdraw to pleasanter pastures when the buzzer clicked on the secretary's desk. Mr. Hobby?
Yes.
Wait 1 minute, Mr. Hobby. Mr. Dasterson wants to see you. Pat waited, squirming a little. Again he saw the face approaching the broken plaster. This time, whoever was behind it raised a finger and tore the wallpaper a little so that they could see better. All right, Mr. Hobby. With a faint dew of sweat on his forehead, Pat went inside. Dasterson received him jovially. Well, old-timer, how's the research expert? Telling Ronson all about the shipyards? Pat looked behind quickly. Apparently no one else was in the office. Just sit down there, Dasterson said, indicating the sofa. Tell me how you're going. Turn your face to the right, will you? Again, Pat glanced around. What is this, he demanded. I don't get it. A little more against the light. There, he raised his voice. All right, Brian. From the little washroom emerged the face that Pat had seen through the chink, a face he would still not have identified if the man hadn't walked to a table and put a bag thereon. It was Mr. DeTink's physician. It is him? Dasterson asked with a grin. I think so, the doctor said. I know I've seen him before, and now I think I know where. Jail loomed, prison doors yawned. And now from the June 30th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine, do we need another green revolution? As the global population grows, we'll have to find ways of feeding the planet without accelerating climate change. By Elizabeth Colbert. The green revolution got off to a rocky start. In the fall of 1944, Norman Borlaug, who would become known as the Revolution's father, moved to Mexico to set up a plant breeding program. Right away, he came down with a stomach crud. It was, he would later tell an interviewer, the usual tourist thing, except that it lasted for weeks. Though he had found his previous position with DuPont to be boring, in those weeks, Borlaug decided that maybe it hadn't been so bad. If I could have gotten my job back at DuPont, I would have, he said. Borlaug had gone to Mexico specifically to work with wheat, which was being devastated by a fungal disease called stem rust. When he got well enough to travel around the country, he became depressed by what he found. In the Bajío, a region northwest of Mexico City, the farmers were desperately poor. Their wheat didn't seem to grow so much as fight to stay alive, Borlaug wrote to his wife. These places that I've seen have clubbed my mind. Borlaug threw himself into an effort to produce a new variety of wheat, one that would be both rust-resistant and higher-yielding. With the help of two Mexican agronomists, he gathered seeds from thousands of local varieties, planted them, and waited for them to mature. Most of the resulting plants succumbed to rust. The few that made it were crossed with one another to produce the next generation. To maximize his work days, Forlaug often slept in a shack near his test fields, and to speed up the breeding process, he shuttled between central Mexico, where wheat was grown in the summer, and northwestern Mexico, where he could get in a second crop in the winter. This went on for years. Progress was made, then it was unmade when a different race of stem rust swept through. Meanwhile, a new issue emerged. Mexican wheat varieties tended to send up tall, slender stalks. If they were dosed with fertilizer, they became more productive, but grew so top-heavy that they fell over, a problem known as lodging. Forlaug began experimenting with a variety of dwarf wheat from Japan. He crossed the Japanese wheat with some doubly rust-resistant varieties he had developed. Finally, he got lucky. The trans-Pacific crosses proved to be not just vigorous and high-yielding, but also surprisingly versatile. They grew well across a range of climatic zones and light conditions. In 1960, Forlaug invited farmers in the northern state of Sonora to visit a plot planted with a number of his best-performing dwarf wheat strains. The farmers went wild. They had been instructed to remain at a distance from the plot, but they refused to listen. Some grabbed at the wheat heads and pocketed the seeds. According to Charles C. Manns, The Wizard and the Prophet, published in 2018, Forlaug, the wizard of the title, was secretly pleased by all the tumult. It was, to him, the soundtrack of success. In later years, Forlaug liked to recite statistics illustrating his seed superiority. In a speech he delivered in Australia in 1968, the year the term Green Revolution was coined, he noted that average wheat yields in Mexico, which had been around 750 kilos per hectare when he'd arrived, had since climbed to almost 2,800 kilos per hectare, a roughly fourfold increase. In western Pakistan, where versions of the Mexican varieties had been introduced in 1965, the results were similarly dramatic. Average yields had risen, he found, by almost 50% in just 2 years. But, as proud as he was of his seeds, Forlaug also saw their limits. When he received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970, he used his Nobel address to caution against complacency. The new varieties of wheat he had bred, along with new strains of rice and corn, which had subsequently been developed, represented, he said, only a temporary success in man's war against hunger and deprivation. The world's population, he predicted, would continue to grow, and eventually the demand for food would again outstrip the supply. Perhaps the term Green Revolution, as commonly used, is premature, Forlaug worried out loud. Today, there are some 8.2 billion people on Earth, more than twice as many as there were when Forlaug won his Nobel Prize. This figure is expected to rise to almost 10 billion by 2050. A few months ago, more than 100 Nobel laureates released an open letter that echoed Forlaug's concerns. They predicted a tragic mismatch of global food supply and demand by mid-century. By their reckoning, we are not on track to meet future food needs. Not even close. Do we need a second Green Revolution? And if so, what form should it take? Two new books, Michael Grunewald's We Are Eating the Earth, The Race to Fix Our Food System and Save Our Climate, published by Simon & Schuster, and Vaclav Smil's How to Feed the World, The History and Future of Food, published by Viking, pursue these questions with varying degrees of urgency. Grunewald is a journalist whose previous books include a history of the Everglades. Humanity, he says, is facing some terrible math. On one side of the equation is the growing need for food. Grunewald estimates that, to keep pace with demand, agricultural production will have to increase by 50% over the next 25 years. On the other side is climate change. Agriculture is a major source of greenhouse gases. depending on how you calculate it, the sector is responsible for between a tenth and a third of global carbon dioxide emissions. To stabilize the climate, this figure has to drop to pretty much zero. We need to feed the world without frying the world, is how Grunwald puts it. Grunwald spends a lot of We Are Eating the Earth interviewing people who have ideas about how this balancing act might be brought off. One group is pushing what's called regenerative agriculture. Grunwald visits a ranch in Northern California, co-owned by the billionaire investor and former presidential candidate Tom Steyer. Instead of rotating his cows among fields every few weeks, Steyer restricts them to a small area and moves them more frequently. The practice, known as adaptive multi-paddock grazing, is supposed to increase the amount of carbon stored in the ranch's soils. This, in turn, is supposed to counteract some or all of the emissions from the operation's ruminants, which are constantly burping out methane, a powerful greenhouse gas. If we can show scientifically that this stuff really works, Steyer says, that would be priceless. A second group wants to take agriculture indoors, thereby freeing up land to plant carbon-sucking forests. Grunwald tours a vertical farm built on the site of an abandoned steel mill in Newark. The farm, which is in fact an enormous warehouse, is filled with lettuce seedlings growing under banks of lights in a mist of chemicals. The plants will never see the sun or touch soil. The future is happening a lot faster than we expected, David Rosenberg, then the CEO of Aero Farms, the company that owns the warehouse, assures Grunwald. A third group wants to eliminate farm animals, or at least reinvent them. Chickens, pigs, and especially cows consume many more calories in the form of plants than they yield up in the form of eggs, chops, and burgers. Getting rid of the middleman, or really middle creature, will, it stands to reason, make the food system that much more efficient. Grunwald talks to Ethan Brown, the founder of Beyond Meat, and Pat Brown, no relation, the founder of Impossible Foods, both of whom have created beef substitutes out of plant-based ingredients like apple extract and pea protein. Grunwald samples ice cream that has been made without any cream, egg whites that have been produced without any eggs, and chocolate mousse made from microbes. The ice cream, he reports, is tasty, the mousse bland. He interviews entrepreneurs who are trying to produce meat from animal cells grown in vats. These include a 20-something from Australia named George Papal, who wants to culture meat from exotic species like Galapagos tortoises. Let's create brand new experience, Papal urges. Grunwald began his reporting for We Are Eating the Earth pre-COVID. What exactly he was expecting to discover is hard to say, but he seems to have set out on writing the book optimistically. The good news is that remarkable people are working on the eating the earth problem, he writes in his introduction. Most of the ventures Grunwald tours, however, turn out to be duds. Steyer hires a research group to monitor his ranch. He learns that, though some metrics are improving, there's less erosion, for example, the soil is not absorbing more carbon. On the contrary, it is absorbing less carbon. Those results are a bummer, a member of the group acknowledges. Vertical farming and fake meat prove, if anything, more disappointing. Even with highly efficient LED bulbs, it takes an awful lot of energy to mimic the sun. Grunwald calculates that to grow just 5% of America's tomatoes indoors would require every megawatt of the country's renewable electricity supply. This has financial as well as climate implications. Aero Farms ends up going bankrupt in 2023, though it has since emerged from Chapter 11. Many of its competitors follow suit. Grunwald interviews Beyond Meat's Ethan Brown just a few months after the company has gone public. Thanks to investor enthusiasm, it has a market capitalization of more than $10 billion. This figure has since dropped by 98%. Impossible Foods is privately held. What little information is available about its finances suggests that its value, too, has crumbled. Many other fake meat ventures, meanwhile, have gone the way of Aero Farms. SCiFi, a company that wanted to create burgers out of a combination of plant-based ingredients and cultivated cells, went belly up in 2024. Motif Foodworks, a company that was using yeast to produce a meaty-tasting protein called hemami, went out of business the same year. Motif's problems were caused, in part, by a patent infringement lawsuit filed by Impossible. Carbon farming and vertical farming are wildly overhyped, Grunewald concludes. Plant-based meat has floundered in the market, while cultivated meat hasn't really made it to the market. He adds, I'm sorry about all that. Grunewald is an engaging storyteller, and to his credit, he sticks with the terrible math, even as it turns terribler and terribler. A reasonable takeaway from We Are Eating the Earth is that the feeding without frying equation is the sort that can be solved only with imaginary numbers. In the absence of breakthroughs, what's to be done? A good first step, Grunewald counsels, would be to stop making things worse. We could start with biofuels. Every year in the United States, some 14 billion gallons of so-called conventional ethanol, most of which are produced from corn, get blended into gasoline. The practice is federally mandated, and one of the justifications for the policy is that it's supposed to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. Almost certainly, though, it has the opposite effect. Diverting corn from grocery stores to gas tanks pushes up commodity prices, which in turn encourages farmers to convert forest and marshes into cropland. Since forest and marshes store a lot of carbon, cutting down or draining them increases atmospheric carbon dioxide. Higher commodity prices also, of course, pose more immediate problems, especially for the world's poor. Grunewald quotes an anti-ethanol protest song by the Jamaican reggae singer Live Broadcast. Biofuel use is going to burn up all my food. Deforestation can only mash up our nation. Evil men with their wicked intention, what is your plan? Is it life or destruction? Another ostensibly green idea that needs rethinking, according to Grunewald, is organic farming. Reducing fertilizer and pesticide use, raising cattle on grass instead of grain, these may sound like community-minded, environmentally friendly options. But if such practices diminish yields, and Grunewald argues convincingly that they do, then they're the reverse. To hold the globe's food supply steady, not to mention increase it, any drop in one farm's output has to be made up somewhere else, and that somewhere may well turn out to be a field cut out of a rainforest. It's trendy to romanticize small family farms where soil is nurtured with love and animals have names rather than numbers, Grunewald writes. But organic, local, and grass-fed are often worse for the climate than conventional imported and feedlot finished. Grunewald travels to Denmark and Brazil with Tim Sertinger, a researcher at Princeton who has written extensively on the climate impacts of agriculture. Bad accounting destroys the world, Sertinger tells him. Vaclav Smil is a professor emeritus at the University of Winnipeg and the author of more than 40 books, several of which also focus on farming. How to Feed the World is a typical Smilian work in that it is dense, declarative, and dismissive of lots of other work. Over the past decade, I have been repeatedly exasperated by people's poor understanding and sheer ignorance of life's many basic realities, be they concerning organisms or machines, crops or engines, food or fuels, he writes. In his introduction, Smil waves aside climate change, saying that he is not going to take up such fashionable topics. Nevertheless, He, too, worries about agriculture's ecological impact. The global food system, he observes, needs to accommodate the nearly 2 billion people that will be added to today's population by the middle of the 21st century, at the same time that it needs to reduce its multitude of environmental burdens. Smil is a number cruncher. His premise is that he doesn't need to visit laboratories or sample ice cream to know what's going to work, and just as important, what is not going to work. Take lab-grown meat. Such meat is produced in bioreactors, which are sterile vats filled with a growing medium. Bioreactors are widely used in drug manufacturing. Smil calculates that to grow just 1% of the globe's current meat output would require something like 100 times the bioreactor capacity of the world's entire pharmaceutical industry. Ambitions and aspirations are one thing, realities are another, he writes. Or consider efforts to improve on photosynthesis. Photosynthesis is woefully inefficient. Even some of the most productive crops convert less than 1% of the solar energy that hits them into calories. So streamlining the process via gene editing could produce significant gains. But Smil is skeptical that this can actually be accomplished. Photosynthesis has been around for hundreds of millions of years and is phenomenally complicated. Prospects for any early commercial breakthroughs on this front are, in his view, meager. The good news, according to Smil, is that breakthroughs aren't necessary. The world could go a long way toward keeping up with food demand simply by better managing the supply. A report commissioned by the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations estimates that globally, about 40% of fruits and vegetables, 30% of cereal grains, and 20% of meat and dairy products wind up uneaten. The problem is worst in affluent countries like the U.S., where more than 200 pounds of food per person get thrown away each year. Even modest food waste reductions would translate into considerable cumulative savings, Smil observes. Then, there's the waste that results from improvident eating habits. If photosynthesis has a low conversion rate, feeding crops to animals compounds the problem many times over. According to Smil, corn embodies about 0.7% of the solar energy that hits it. When corn is used as cow fodder, the resulting stakes embody only about 0.002% of the original energy. Pigs and chickens do better at turning grain into flesh. Still, producing a pound of pork or chicken takes many more resources than producing the same amount of, say, cornmeal. Reducing meat consumption, Smil argues, would be both rational and highly desirable. Rates of meat eating vary widely around the world. At the low end are countries like India and Ethiopia, where the average person consumes just 13 pounds of meat per year. The U.S. lies at the upper end, weighing in at more than 260 pounds per capita. Chinese rates of consumption are now also high, around 150 pounds per person, after having doubled in just the past three decades. Some of these differences reflect cultural and gastronomical traditions. But economics also plays a big and ethically awkward role. From a global perspective, the U.S. diet is too meat-heavy. But how do you get Americans to cut back or the Chinese to hold steady? And how do you persuade any country to take on food waste? Smil offers a few possibilities, including measures to raise the price of groceries. Though he acknowledges that this would be unpopular, he says that this isn't really his concern, as his book is, quote, more interested in science than politics, end quote. The strength of How to Feed the World is its emphasis on realism. How realistic is it, though, to leave politics out of the calculation? When Norman Borlaug died in 2009 at the age of 95, his Times obituary praised him for having done more than anyone else in the 20th century to teach the world to feed itself. The Associated Press called him equal parts scientist and humanitarian. An MIT Technical Review described his life as one of heroic proportions. Were it not for Borlaug and the Green Revolution, the world in the late 20th century would have been a very different place. Food prices probably would have been a lot higher. The number of people who are malnourished would have been greater. And even more millions of acres of forest would have been transformed into fields. And yet, by the time of Borlaug's death, his accomplishments were looking increasingly equivocal. The Green Revolution, critics pointed out, may have alleviated some problems, but it created additional ones. And these tended to impose the highest burdens on precisely those communities the new seeds were supposed to help. Borlaug's wheat varieties were highly productive. They were also fussy. They performed well only when showered with nutrients, pesticides, and water. This meant that the gains from planting them went disproportionately to those who could afford such inputs, which is to say, those farmers who were already relatively well off. The poorest farmers, for their part, often found themselves forced to sell out. Even if the Green Revolution reduced the price of a commodity like rice by 60%, Raj Patel, a research professor at the University of Texas at Austin, has written that this would have been little consolation to those farmers who lost 100% of their income. Increased water, pesticide, and fertilizer use, meanwhile, led to a host of environmental problems. In India, for example, the government encouraged farmers to irrigate their thirsty new crops by drilling into underground aquifers. Some 30 million so-called tube wells were sunk. Now, after several decades of pumping, many aquifers are running dry. According to a recent editorial in the Deccan Herald, India is facing its worst groundwater crisis in history. Adding to this crisis, much of the groundwater that remains is contaminated. A report issued last year by the Indian government found that 20% of the samples taken from around the country contained unsafe level of nitrates. Nitrates in drinking water are particularly dangerous for infants who can develop what's known as blue baby syndrome. The report blamed the problem on excessive use of fertilizers. In the 80 years since Borlaug arrived in Mexico, farming in much of the world has been transformed. New tools that could make farms even more productive are constantly being developed, from CRISPR to remote sensing drones and weeding machines that shoot out lasers. At the same time, the world, too, has been transformed by such things as climate change, groundwater depletion, and soil contamination. The new tools and the new threats are bound up in each other, two sides, as it were, of the same leaf. If it is reasonable to imagine that we will somehow or other find ways to feed 10 billion people, it is also reasonable to fear how much damage will be done in the process. Next, from the June 30th, 2025 issue of The New Yorker, your hip surgery, my headache. Getting Hugh home after his hip replacement involved a thick cushion and a car with legroom. "Ow," he said whenever I tried to help. "You're making everything worse." By David Sedaris. The year my sister Amy was invited to play Mrs. Claus in the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade was the same year Hugh had his hip replaced. "It somehow makes sense that these two things are happening within a week of each other," I said. "Except I'm not doing it," Amy told me. It was nearly midnight. We were in my apartment in New York, gathered in the living room. The view from the window looked like the backdrop of a talk show. A jumble of tall buildings with thousands of lit windows, some of them winking. "How can you not play Mrs. Claus?" I asked. Amy ticked the reasons off on her fingers. "One, they want me there at 3 a.m. 2, it's supposed to rain. And 3, they're not paying me anything." Macy's doesn't pay Mrs. Claus? I asked, surprised in the same way I'd be if I learned that she, Mrs. Claus, had been married before, maybe to another woman. Like, what? That can't be true. With us in the living room were two Frenchmen whom Hugh and I know from Normandy. Olivier, who owns a donkey and had been teaching himself English with Duolingo, and David, who also has a donkey, but spoke no English whatsoever. Still, he could understand by my tone that something outrageous was happening. Qu'est-ce que c'est passé? He asked. The department store that calls itself the House of Macy will not give money to the bride of Father Christmas, I said in French. For us, this is unacceptable. Olivier and David had arrived a week earlier and were staying with us until the Saturday after Thanksgiving. It was their first trip to New York, and they were overwhelmed by how loud and crowded the city was. My sister Gretchen, who lives in North Carolina, was also staying with us, and while I was happy to see her and our French friends, I had just returned from a long tour and had not had any time alone, or alone with just Hugh, since mid-September. We have a good deal of room in our New York apartment. It's not like anyone was sleeping on a sofa or hanging wet towels off the doorknobs. I just resented having to adjust my schedule. House guests meant less time at my desk, both in the morning and in the evening, when, mainly because of Gretchen, we had to eat dinner earlier than usual. I can put up with a lot, but when my work schedule is interrupted, I get antsy. It didn't help that just 4 days after Gretchen was due to leave, Hugh would be checking into the hospital for hip surgery. And don't think I'm not going to need you, he said over Thanksgiving dinner. A whiz in the kitchen, Hugh makes all our meals, and when I suggested that he could probably still manage, I'm sure other people have, can't you cook like from a wheelchair or something? He said, no, you're going to do it. 3 times a day and for as long as I need you to. He poured himself a glass of wine. I could be out of commission for months. Yes, but you don't know that for a fact, I reminded him. I'm sure there are people who recover from a hip replacement in a matter of days. You just don't hear about them. David asked what we were talking about, and I said in French, after the hospital, he wants to make a strike. However difficult Hugh's operation would be, I doubted that it could be worse than the year and a half leading up to it. There was no one day he started complaining about his pain. He's always done that to some degree. Rather, it shifted from his back or his sciatica to his hip and then stayed there and intensified. Ow! He'd cry, wincing as he sat down at the lunch or dinner table, as he bent before the oven or even looked at a stepladder. Hugh never says anything so simple as, I have a headache or my finger hurts. Instead, he describes his pain in detail, the way he might to a doctor who just said, tell me everything and I want you to be as specific as possible. I know when Hugh is on the phone with his mother, because all his talk will be about his sore wrist, his swollen joint, the cut on his foot. When I offer to get him an ice pack, an ibuprofen, a Band-Aid, he'll say in a voice that is weak but also bitter, that's okay, I'll get it myself later if I need to. They don't hand out medals for needless suffering, I'll remind him. You don't know what it's like, he'll tell me. I know all about kidney stones and gum surgery. I know about broken ribs and urinary tract infections. When it came to hip pain, though, he had me. His groaning would sometimes wake me in the middle of the night. Listen, I'd tell him, if I could take your pain and suffer it myself, I would, if only to get a decent night's sleep. This went on day after day, until I could no longer remember its absence. Hugh became a non-stop grouse. Ghosts in movies moaned less than he did. Still, it took a lot to get him to see a specialist. The doctor said it's bone on bone, he reported after returning from his appointment. Do you have the slightest idea of what that feels like? 2 months after Thanksgiving, Hugh would turn 65 and be eligible for Medicare. But even that was too long to wait. Luckily, we have health insurance, and it appeared that our plan would cover the brunt of the cost. And so, in what seemed like very little time, he was scheduled for surgery at one of the hospitals within a short walking distance of our apartment. There are a number of them, so many that when our friend Tracy was looking for a place on the Upper East Side, and we suggested our part of it, she instead chose to get something 30 blocks north. All the Google Street views I looked at in your neighborhood showed people who were crying, she told us. It's something I hadn't noticed until she said it. Then I thought, she's right. If our sidewalks are clean, it's likely due to a steady downpour of tears, mostly in the vicinity of Memorial Sloan Kettering. The place Hugh went to was called the Hospital for Special Surgery. It's the best, his doctor said, as did many of the retired residents in our building who'd had their hips and knees and shoulders replaced there. If you need a walker or wheelchair, just ask, any one of them would tell us. I've got one in the basement. A neighbor said that she still had some painkillers left. Another offered to loan us her comfort height toilet seat. Hugh passed, but wound up buying his own. The doctor says I'll need it, he told me. The sight of the puffy, foot-tall toilet seat in our home was too much for me. A specter of death no less chilling than the Grim Reaper himself. I said, next, bring in a coffin, why don't you? The day before his surgery, Hugh talked to his older brother, John, in Washington State, and then limped into my office to recap their conversation. He said he really wished he was here to help take care of me. I looked up from my laptop. Call him back. Well, I don't know that he really meant it, Hugh said. I handed him my phone. Sure he did. Call him. Do it now. Well, John can't afford a last-minute ticket across the country, Hugh told me, and I know for a fact that he won't want to drive 3 hours from his house to the Seattle airport. He won't have to, I said. Call him. That was at 3 p.m. New York time. By 5, a hired car was heading to Port Angeles to collect Hugh's brother, and by midnight, John was in a first-class seat to JFK, where another car would be waiting to deliver him to our apartment. I said to Amy, it's worth every penny. I like all of Hugh's siblings. Each is creative in his or her own way. John, for instance, can make a sculpture out of anything. Hand him an empty sardine tin, 3 chopsticks, and a broken calculator, and he'll turn it into something remarkable. He's a wonderful writer as well, and a huge reader. John is warm and inquisitive. He's big-hearted and energetic, and I'd always look forward to his visits, especially now. He can cook, right? I asked. Well, sure, you said, but it's just regular stuff he makes for his grandkids, pork chops, macaroni and cheese. That kind of thing. Well, that'll do, I told him, at least until you can stand on your feet long enough to pan-fry scallops. John hadn't yet arrived when I collected Hugh's overnight bag and accompanied him to the hospital for his operation. For years, I'd heard horror stories about American healthcare, but this place was first rate. After checking in, we were led to a small, spotless room with curtains for walls. There was an examining table set up, and once Hugh had changed into a medical gown, we were visited by 6 staff members, starting with a nurse who inserted an IV into the back of his hand and cleaned out his nose with iodine. An aide shaved and then washed the hip that needed replacing. Then came another nurse who took a vial of Hugh's blood and asked a series of questions, including, when did you last have a bowel movement? I put my fingers in my ears. I made the noise of 100,000 bees. Are you okay? The young woman said. We don't do things like that, I told her, rocking back and forth, my fingers still in my ears. Things like what? We don't have bowel movements, I explained. The bathrooms at our house are for soaking in the tub and brushing our teeth. That's it. Nothing else has ever happened there. I know couples who sit on the toilet with the door open, who merrily pass gas in front of each other and discuss their evacuations in graphic detail. But Hugh and I are not those people. Hearing his answer to the nurse's question could have possibly destroyed me. And so I kept my fingers in my ears until she left and the anesthesiologist arrived. Then came another nurse and finally the surgeon, Dr. Reif, who we learned had just amputated a leg. Sitting in the curtained off room, listening as patients to the left and right of us were asked about their bowel movements too, I realized that I had never seen Hugh frightened before. "You'll be fine," I told him, patting his hand and noticing for the first time that it had age spots on it. At 11 a.m., right on schedule, a gurney pulled up. Hugh was outfitted with a bonnet, and after he was wheeled away, I went home to meet John, who has visited us in France and England, but, like Olivier and David, had never before been to New York. All the Hamrick brothers are handsome, though in slightly different ways, like dogs born in different litters to the same purebred parents. John's jaw is squarer than Hugh's and Sam's, and his thick hair, even as he turns 70, has hardly any gray in it. His gait is looser, and he's more affectionate, always ready to lay a hand on your shoulder and perhaps surprise you with a kiss on the cheek. "Ick," I said when we greeted each other. "Get off of me." Walking from my apartment to the Morgan Library, where we would have lunch, took 3 times as long as it normally would because John kept stopping in the middle of the sidewalk to look up. "Wow, did you see the detail on that building?" A woman slammed into his back, the way I myself have done 1,000 times when a tourist, oblivious to the people around him, quits moving in order to gawk and point. "You could at least apologize," John shouted after her once she skittered around him, muttering. We were eating when the surgeon called to say that he had finished and that there had been no complications. It hadn't occurred to me that anything might have gone wrong, though I suppose it easily could have. 8 years earlier, John's wife, a woman he'd been with since he was 14, the mother of his child, died of a blood clot after breaking her leg. Totally unexpected, and his entire life was derailed. I'm still not sure how he makes it from one day to the next, and in such good humor. Time helps, I imagine, as do all the philosophy books he reads. For a while, he saw a therapist. Now he dates a woman who lives down the street from him and makes her own greeting cards. It's amazing how quickly doctors can get hip replacement patients back on their feet. The morning after the operation, John and I entered the hospital and found Hugh shuffling down a hallway. He had a physical therapist by his side and was using a walker. But still, getting him home a short time later involved a thick cushion and a car with plenty of legroom. "Ah," he said whenever I tried to help, "you're making everything worse." In the apartment, he steered his walker toward the bed. "I'm going to need you to take my shoes off," he said to me, adding, as I began to do so, "slowly. Now put my slippers on." "Not like that. Get me my shoehorn." He needed a blanket, his phone, a glass of water. "Not that much water," he complained when I handed it to him. There were prescriptions to be picked up and sick room equipment, for instance, an adjustable stool he'd need when getting in and out of bed. I went to 4 different places looking for one. At CVS, I came upon a well-dressed, white-haired woman who had in her shopping cart a pack of wet wipes and 8 quart-sized cartons of half and half. "God, that's a lot of half and half," I said to her. "Who on earth needs that much?" "Well, I'm having guests," she snapped, and I scurried away. That evening, I went with Amy to our friend Mike's for dinner. "I can't believe you're abandoning me," he said as I dressed to leave. I reminded him that it had been on the calendar for months, and I'm not abandoning you. John is here. It was nice to get away, if only for a few hours, to have someone bring me bowls of nuts and glasses of water. At the table, I mentioned the lady who'd growled at me at CVS. Then Mike told us about a woman who'd spotted Ted Koppel carrying a basketful of avocados at a farm stand in Maryland. "Making guacamole," she said. "None of your goddamn business," he reportedly answered. I recapped the evening for Hugh the following morning, saying that there were plenty more parties coming up. "Hopefully you can come with me to Antonio's Christmas lunch in 2 weeks. We had so much fun last year. Remember?" 2 weeks, Hugh gestured toward his outstretched leg. "Look at me. Are you out of your mind? John, who had gone that morning to buy a juicer, set a glass of something that poured like wet cement in front of his brother and raised his voice, which was unlike him. My God, David, he's just had major surgery. I raised my voice in return. Well, excuse me, I thought eventually he might get better. By outsourcing Hugh's care, I had shut myself out of his recovery. Now I wanted back in, but it was too late. After saying, whatever you do, don't give him a bell, Amy brought Hugh an empty can she'd put a few quarters in. Clang, 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 I'd hear while sitting at my desk. Clang, clang. How can I help? I'd ask, racing into the bedroom. John is downstairs, Hugh would say. Go get him and tell him I need to put my socks on. I'd roll up my sleeves. I can do that for you. Just go get John. The two were inseparable and would convene each morning to dissect their dreams. So I'm back in Port Angeles under a pitch black sky frying, get this, pennies in a skillet. I caught John saying a week after his arrival, as he sat on the edge of the bed, massaging oil into Hugh's feet. I might be wrong, but I'm interpreting this to mean I could use more copper and iron in my diet. At meals, the brothers would reflect on their childhoods in Africa. Remember that CIA agent who had a crush on Mom in Djibouti? What was the name of that Belgian nun in Ethiopia who we gave our monkey to? It made it hard to join the conversation. This as opposed to when Amy would visit. Shortly after Hugh's operation, she had her elderly rabbit, Tina, put to sleep. A few days later, nose stuffed up and with puffy eyes, she came to dinner. Is it a cold? John asked. Actually, Amy said, I think I'm allergic to Tina's ghost. Hugh has a sister named Anne. And one morning I walked into the dining room and found him talking with her on speakerphone. Do you have comfortable enough chairs? She asked. The answer would normally be yes, but on account of his hip, he had to be raised up while sitting. Oh, there are a few that are okay if I put a cushion on them, Hugh told her, gesturing for me to refill his coffee cup. At my doctor's office yesterday, I saw one that would be perfect, but there's no way David would allow it into the apartment. It's too ugly. Well, screw him, I heard Anne say. We're talking about your health here. The next morning, she sent a text that read, Is David any help to you? Before Hugh could answer, I picked up his phone and typed, None at all, adding an emoji, my first time ever, of a skunk. I expected her to respond with, You're kidding, or I don't believe that for one second. Instead, she wrote, That sort of angers me. But then, he's so self-involved. Rather than texting her back, I returned to my office and resumed writing in my diary. Self-involved indeed, I thought. Hugh hadn't shown me the chair he was talking to Anne about, but if it was truly that ugly, I'm sure he wouldn't have wanted it either. Why was I the villain here? Hugh went off his painkillers after the third day. After the eighth, he cast aside his walker and was able to get around using a cane. He made it to the lobby, slowly, then all the way to the corner. Now that he didn't need quite as much attention, I started taking John to see a bit of the city. One afternoon, on the C train, we came upon a man who had peed on himself and had likely been doing so for quite a while. The stench of old urine was so intense that it had emptied half the subway car. Neither awake nor asleep, he sat slumped beside a dribbling vodka bottle, muttering. Check, I thought, since that's something every visitor to New York needs to see. After looking at this man for a moment or two, John remarked not on the smell or on the ridiculous Santa hat the man wore, but on his hands. Did you notice how beautiful they are? He asked. I took him to lunch at a deli in Carnegie Hall. Just as our orders arrived, I heard someone ask, Can we get a picture? Must I thought, looking to my right and realizing that the person was talking not to me, but to Kevin Spacey. Hasn't he been canceled? John asked, much more loudly than he needed to. Well, it still counts as a star sighting, I told him, thinking, check. We went to the Met and the MoMA, and then to the most garish of souvenir shops so that John could buy sweatshirts for his grandsons. In Times Square, he stood stock still and took photos of billboards as people who work in that neighbor cursed the pair of us. I said to Hugh when we got home, I even took him to see the tree at Rockefeller Center. That was huge, as no one in their right mind goes anywhere near Rockefeller Center from Thanksgiving to mid-January or so. What do you want, a medal? Hugh asked. I tried to remember that he was still in pain and that trapped inside for all but 30 minutes a day, he was going a little stir-crazy. It was hard for both of us, but became surprisingly easier when, shortly before Christmas, John returned to Washington State. On that morning, I accompanied Hugh to his surgeon's office for a follow-up appointment. Any questions? Dr. Reef asked after removing Hugh's bandage to examine the wound. Yes, I said. Do you see any reason why he can't cook Christmas dinner? We have 9 guests coming, and he's threatening to have it catered. The doctor replaced the bandage. Oh, I think he's up to it. That said, you might want to take a few shortcuts, use stovetop stuffing rather than homemade, that sort of thing. Stuffing from a box, I said when we were back on the street. Stuffing, period? As if we'd have turkey on Christmas Day? That man did not know who he was talking to, did he? No, he did not, Hugh sniffed, raising his cane to hail a cab, and with that he was back. Christmas nearly killed him, but no shortcuts were taken. He made a second entree for the vegetarians and 2 desserts. Given a few more days, he might have even churned his own butter. I left New York in early January to go back on tour, and when I saw Hugh again, 6 weeks later, he was fully recovered. Walking, swimming, going up and down stairs, it's a miracle, he said. I once met a young man who discovered, by accident, that one of his kidneys was dead inside him. Doctors removed it, and when I asked what happened to the cavity, he said that his other organs had shifted slightly to occupy it. That's what happened to the space Hugh had filled with his pain. It's not like we now devote it exclusively to politics or art appreciation, though both subjects grew larger, as did talk of our families and our friends. As he became his old self again, the pleasantness of our life together just sort of swelled, crowding out everything but a half a bottle of OxyContin and a really tall toilet seat, now gathering cobwebs beside an aluminum walker in our building's dank, uninviting basement. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.